There we are. Starfire 59, is that it?
I enjoy it.
Okay, good. Well, maybe in the future we'll play some more Starflyer. But yeah, that was sort of a blind show. Well, hey, everybody who's listening online, I just found out that because of me and my great technical skill, I forgot to hit the OK button on the recorder. So the first half hour of the show didn't record, which means that if you're listening online, you're just now joining us.
On RadioFreeNashville.org or podcast?
There'll be both. Well, actually, it won't be on Radio Free. You can only listen live on Radio Free Nashville.
Yeah, so if you're listening live on Radio Free Nashville, you've been with us for 38 minutes.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And if you're listening to us, and it's Monday, and it's
right,
then you've missed 38
minutes. You've missed 38 minutes, but nothing important happened, trust me.
That was late. That was significant.
Yeah, Joey was late. That's about the only thing significant that happened. And you are listening to Christian Descent Live on 98.9 WRFN, Pasco, Tennessee, Radio Free Nashville, low power to the people, online at www.radiofreenashville.org, where you can donate or listen live, and you can, of course, catch the blog for the show at christiandescent.blogspot.com, and both of my cohorts here have blogs, tvonthefritz.blogspot.com for Joey, and Scrambies. For Josh.
And
Josh.
You can just go to the Christian Defense site and link to either of those.
Yeah. And you go to joshtinley.com, and then you can see pictures of Josh's cute little... how old is mine?
18 months.
Okay. I don't know the kid. I've never met him, but I've seen the picture. I feel like I do because they've documented his entire life online.
Yeah, we want to get video up soon.
Well, we want to talk about real quick. Coming up next week, I have a show that I'm excited about. We have Mark Tooley from the IRD, Institute for Religion and Democracy, and part of UM Action, and he's coming on. And they're a sort of conservative group. Some people would say they're outside agitators, but we'll talk about.
So is it going to be our first conservative on there?
Well, yeah, since we've done this format, yes.
Exciting.
I did have one conservative on the old show.
Will there be donuts and refreshments first?
If you want to bring some, yeah, go right ahead. Mark Tooley will be on, and then we'll have a representative from Reconciling Ministry Networks talking about this whole controversy at the Lake Junaluska Conference Center of the United Methodist Church. And Josh, give us a quick intro on what's going on and what's happened so far.
Well, at Lake Junaluska Conference Center, which is in North Carolina, it's operated by the Southeastern Jurisdiction of the United Methodist Church, if I understand correctly, mm-hmm. which is an assortment of conferences in the United Methodist Church, obviously located in the Southeast. But the Reconciling Ministries Network, which is the advocacy group for gays and lesbians in the United Methodist Church, has basically arranged to have their conference at Lake Junaluska, which has raised a great deal of controversy because some have argued that the official stance of the United Methodist Church is such that we should not be supporting a group that, I don't know how you would say it, a group that is okay
so
with...
gay.
Right. There we go. So there's been a big, big controversy about it, and recently... in the conference where Lake Junaluska is located, the Western North Carolina Conference, J. Lawrence McCleskey, who's the bishop there, has written an open letter to all his congregations in that area, explaining why he feels that allowing Reconciling Ministries to have their Hearts on Fire conference at the Lake Junaluska Retreat Center is consistent with what the Book of Discipline says. And a big part of it is the fact that the church itself, the conference, the jurisdiction, is not paying a cent for this. This is all being funded by Reconciling Ministries and their own fundraising channels. So the church is not paying for this. They're just allowing use of the facility, which I believe they allow to be used by other non-official groups
right.
that, you know.
Well, I mean, and there's that group that the anti-abortion group in the Methodist Church trying to change Methodist policy on abortion. I mean, they use conference centers and church facilities. So
that's not entirely consistent with the Book of Discipline
right,
either. So,
right. I'm really excited about next week's show because to talk about Mark Tooley, because I hear a lot about IRD. And I don't know anybody who's directly affiliated with it, so I'm not sure how much I hear that is rumor or true or whatever. And there's stuff that I hear is not good, at least in my opinion. So, and we try, even though we are a progressive and liberal show, when we talk to Mark, we keep a nice level head and try to actually educate ourselves on IRD. But from what I understand, they use a lot of outside money to sort of agitate within the church, and they agitate for change in their direction. And I think some of the ways that they do it, and some of the ways, at least that I've heard, again, I'm not making any direct accusations to IRD, just what I've heard, are not very sort of Christian and not very friendly.
Are you going to call them on that?
Well, I'm going to ask them about it, and I'm sure he's been asked about it before, and I hope that what I've heard about IRD is not true, because I would hate that. I mean, it makes me hurt that such an organization, that is from what it's been painted to me, is around. So you guys can't accuse, nobody out there can accuse me of just making blanket liberal statements and not listening to conservatives, because we do invite conservatives onto the show, and I like to try to get an idea of their perception, because who knows, how much of our conflict is just, we just don't understand each other. So, we'll have some talk with Mark, and also the guy from Reconciling after that.
Both going to be on this? Oh,
yeah.
Not together.
Yeah, they're going to be on one after the other, but they will be both be on, so we'll have two interviews.
Okay.
It'll be a good week. And actually, something I'm real excited about, I just got confirmed last week, is that the General Secretary of the National Council of Churches, Bob Edgar, will be joining us in September.
Labor Day weekend.
Yeah. So that will it'll be a good show. They've confirmed, excited about that. Because National Council of Churches, if you look at it, it's a liberal, progressive organization, basically. I mean, they do a lot of progressive politics. And they've sort of been painted, misrepresented really badly by IRD.
And other groups.
And other groups.
I think I have a lot of questions for him about this, because it does make me nervous when the National Council of Churches comes out and takes circumstances. Well, when they agree with me too much, I guess it makes me nervous, because I know there's a lot in the churches they represent, a lot of people who don't agree with me at all and who would be uncomfortable with those statements. And even though I think those are consistent with Christian teaching, others don't.
Yeah, it should be an interesting show, and I encourage people to look up National Council of Churches and look up some of the controversy, and email us. If you guys have questions on any of our guests, email us, and we'll try, if they're reasonable questions, they're not mean and hateful, we will try to get them to ask, because, one of the things I want to do with having a wide variety of guests on the show is try to educate and try to help, figure out what's going on, because there is a lot of misinformation on both sides. There's a lot of conservative organizations that are misrepresented and painted in a poor light by liberals, and there's a lot of liberal organizations that are misrepresented and painted in poor light by conservatives. So hopefully we'll be able to resolve some of that. But that should be a good show with Bob Edgar. So check out, what is that, Labor Day weekend?
Yeah, September 4th. And just speaking of Labor Day really quick, I would advise our listeners, whether live or otherwise, to visit untiedmethodist.com. It's United Methodist with the I and the D switch. There's a really good three-part interview with Sheila Collins of the National Jobs for All Coalition on how to advocacy efforts towards getting full employment at a living wage in the country, and debunking some of the criticisms about that movement, living wage movement. And it's a really good, really good interview and very informative.
So what you're saying is that it's possible for everybody to be employed and to be able to feed themselves and their children.
It makes sense that they can be around.
That's true.
But Sheila Collins, who's interviewed, has a little more insight into how to get that done in a way that would make people happy.
Well, that's interesting. That's something that, that is a real social justice issue that is sort of, we get so tied up in, our controversial you know, meaningless stuff that we do in the church that we forget and we put aside poverty and joblessness and the real sort of core, things that Jesus would talk about,
right.
and we need to remember to stay focused on that.
Because they don't rile people necessarily.
Right. Well, yeah, because
it's a very boring issue.
You can't walk into a, you can't fill up your church on just a Sunday and go, let's cure homelessness.
Write letters to our elected representatives.
Yeah.
Here's this paper.
That's something. Yeah, just
talk about that.
Yeah, I would.
First, before you talk about that, what's the phone number in case? Because I know that one of my friends is listening to me.
Okay, well, great.
Does he live within a mile and a half radius of?
No, he's listening on the internet.
Okay, well, the studio line is 615-662-8229. 615-662-8229. So, no area code if you're in the Nashville area. If you're not in the Nashville area, call. And if you're listening to a stream later, if you call that number, there'll be some other show on the air, and you won't be us. They might have to talk to somebody, but they might not know what you're talking about.
Which will be bad.
And some of the other shows on Radio Free Nashville are really good. If you could come up or listen online, there's some really. Music-wise, I found this is probably my favorite station when I can get it.
Well, you definitely get stuff on this station that you don't get anywhere else. This is anti-corporate radio, so we...
Which means we have no...
Yeah. Justice Sunday. I went to Justice Sunday. I went to both. There was the rally at the Cathedral of Praise, and then I went to the real thing. It was kind of fun.
I watched on television.
Because I had a media pass. And so I got over this
for Radio Nashville or your blog?
But for here, I don't think they would have given it to me. They did have bloggers there, but I don't know if they would have given it to me. But I had the media pass, so we had this big old media room. And this thing was huge with like 100 chairs in it and about 15 or 20, 30 media people. And then a nice spread of food, which is the only reason I stayed, just through the entire thing.
That fades to me.
Sandwiches and fruit and some good tea. And hopes, it was a nice little setup, but man, those people have a chip on their shoulder.
The media or
the people who did it. First of all, I don't want to be mean to Jet Williams, but that was one of the worst musical performances I have ever been accustomed to. I mean, it was horrible. Jet Williams is like Hank Williams' illegitimate daughter or something, and she's been writing this.
Hank Williams Jr., did you say?
No, I think Hank Williams, because she's like 50.
Oh, is she?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't realize it.
Yeah, we actually had the same discussion in the press room.
Yeah, it's not Hollywood, it's medical.
Yeah, and I'm sure she's a sweet woman, but I guess her name has gotten her some notoriety, but man, ooh, that was bad. Never been to St. James was good. I was kind of sad she was there, but... she did it. But, one of the most interesting things that it used to be when conservatives spoke about gay sex or whatever, they'd say sodomy. Sodomy is bad, sodomy is evil, sodomy, sodomy, sodomy. Now they go homosexual sodomy. And that's just sort of a weird phrase to begin with. And every speaker said it. They didn't say...
So they're okay with heterosexual.
Right. So apparently, they've actually progressed. Mm-hmm. So apparently, the only sodomy that is actually bad is homosexual sodomy. And this is a change in the movement. I mean, they didn't always used to label it homosexual sodomy.
Yeah,
it used to just
be
sodomy.
A lot of conservative denominations, their official policy is still sodomy.
But we can say, I think we're supposed to say that the Family Research Council... and you heard it here, has no particular issue with heterosexual sodomy.
Sometimes they are changing.
I don't want to get into a discussion of this. Well, I'm curious in the whole the abstinence movement. Is this a loophole, or is this something that married couples can do? And
kids do use it. I mean, there are
it is used as a loophole, and
which
boggles the mind.
These fundamentalist teenagers and Jesus freaks and But you know, they have okay. Anyway, well, we have a couple more minutes before John Graham comes on to speak with us. In the news again today or this last week has been this whole intelligent design thing. Now, me personally, I don't understand. I don't have a problem with evolution. You know, the theory of evolution does not destroy my faith. It is not contradictory to my faith, and it does not threaten my faith. But for apparently lots of people, it is. Evolution is like the great Satan.
Right.
And I don't get it. But they have this intelligent design thing.
I've been doing some reading on this, actually.
Okay.
See what I can say. I think a big part of the intelligent design movement, from what I can tell, at first when I read about it, I just thought it was basically evolution with God.
Mm-hmm.
God is doing the evolution, which is what I've always kind of subscribed to anyway, so that didn't really bother me. But I think that now the more I read about it, there are big challenges to evolution, and it's kind of the distinction between micro and macro evolution. Evolution can take place and very, very small increments, but it cannot generate totally new species, is their argument. That takes a greater intelligence. So it's not creationism in the traditional sense, because the official stance of intelligent design is they're not telling us who the intelligent designer is. They're just saying there is one. My problem with it, and I'm still, you know, I want to give them a fair shake, because I think, one thing I think they do, and I will give them credit, they do make some pretty good arguments questioning some things that evolutionists have taken as fact. And I think that's fine. I think it's important to raise questions and criticisms about any accepted theory. My problem is when they assign God to fill in those gaps.
Yeah, it's like if we don't know the answer, then it must be God.
Right. And, you know, I know they do have, say, there's scientific evidence pointing to a greater intelligence that it had to be intelligence. There's no other way to explain it. My worry is, and Bill Frist just came out in support of intelligent design, I guess, Friday.
Well, he had to make up for the stem cells.
Right. And I mean, I don't know. It sounded to me like he wasn't planning on talking about that, but some reporters wanted to get a statement on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, obviously they're going to get a big story out of that. But that he spoke out in favor. My problem is, if intelligent design becomes mainstream science, it either replaces or becomes an alternative to evolution, then you have God being a provable scientific fact. And no matter, I'm not a scientist, I don't claim to be, but say, just hypothetically, intelligent design turns out to be a more viable theory than evolution.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that it will, but say it does. And then eventually somebody's going to come along with evidence that is more for a theory that's more viable than the current intelligent design theory, I would think, anyway. And then you put God in a place where God is determined by scientific experiments and evidence, and that just kind of sucks the magic out of it.
My issue, you definitely read more on the actual intelligent design theory than I have, but my issue with this whole thing is the conservative, the religious right, has been getting smarter about the language they use.
And how
they present their arguments. I mean, used to it was creationism, and it was God created the world in 7 days.
And there's still a lot of young earth creationists out there.
And that was it. And after decades of trying to get that, in the schools and trying to make that a viable issue, and it never happened. I mean, people just mean, please, we can't teach creationism. So then they sort of regrouped, and they've done this on lots of issues. And they said, we have to find a way to reframe it. So, I mean, my fear is that it's the same thing. Just they've instead of actually deciding, I mean, in science, and scientists email me if I'm wrong, you do experiments and then you reach a conclusion. You don't reach a conclusion and then try to make your experiments.
Right.
That's how they work.
And I think intelligent design is trying to play against that perception in two ways. They're trying to say, A, that evolution is actually based on a leap of faith itself, and that Charles Darwin, and they really, you know, when you look at Darwin's diaries, he really did have a problem with the problem of evil in the world and didn't understand how a creator God could have done that. And was looking for a way to separate the creator from the creation.
Mm-hmm.
but I don't think that's not how he arrived at evolution, but evolution worked and solving that problem for him. So they're trying to go back historically and say that evolution was a leap of faith in itself, which there might be some truth to that, but I'm not totally convinced that that's so. And there's been plenty of scientific progress since then that has been purely scientific. And then also the other way they're trying to do that is to say that they are starting with the evidence and coming to the conclusion of an intelligent designer, which obviously you can argue that too.
I have a question. When did this all come about? Was it recently? I mean, I know.
I think around the late 70s, early 80s is when it really picked up. I think Philip Johnson was the first. And he wasn't a biologist. He was actually a lawyer with a background in mathematics.
Which makes him perfect for developing books.
But they have had some credentialed scientists at major universities on their side, and that's another way they've really tried to reframe the debate and say that we have scientific people, not just theologians now.
Well, it's an interesting issue, and I think we'll probably have to do a show on it, and maybe I'll do more research and have some of these experts on, because I frankly don't know that much about it.
Yeah, it's still something I'm trying to get a handle on. I've tried to do a lot of reading, but again, I'm not a scientist, so.
Well, anyway, we have, so we'll do that. But we have, right now we have John Graham about to come on from the Giraffe Heroes Project, author of Stick Your Neck Out, and I'm going to get him on the phone if y'all want to listen to some classic Newsboys. Tennessee, Radio Free Nashville, Low Power to the People. I'm Cole Wakefield, and I'm one of your hosts. I'm also here with Joey Hood and Josh Tinley. And on the phone, we have John Graham, president of the Giraffe Heroes Project, and author of Stick Your Neck Out, A Street Smart Guide to Creating Change in Your Community and Beyond, Service as a Path to a Meaningful Life. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Cole.
How are things? There? It's still dark in California?
Yeah, I'm in an island in Washington State. I've got a great big cup of coffee in front of me.
Yeah, I know you were out west somewhere there. Well, thanks for getting up early and joining us. I want to say I've been looking for your book, Stick Your Neck Out, and I have to say I was disappointed because I didn't have this when I started doing activism work as a youth activist years ago. I've been recommending to people, anybody who wants to sort of just get into creating change in your community, to do it. What led you to put this book together?
I think, frankly, because I can. I'm at this stage of my life. I'm 63 years old, and I've done all kinds of things in my life, including 15 years in the Foreign Service, where I was in the middle of wars and revolutions and arms sales and all stuff like that. Gradually, at a certain point in my life, it really began during a rough year and a half in Vietnam. My life started to turn around, and I began, thinking about, well, what's my life about? I look up into a starry sky trying to get some sense of where I sit in this creation. And just being a warrior and being in the middle of these wars and revolutions and arms sales didn't seem like a very satisfactory answer for a life.
Right.
So I began to look at life through more as a path to service, and I ended up my Foreign Service career working under Jimmy Carter and Andrew Young at the United Nations. And I can say that I had something to do with, for example, ending apartheid and some other things that I feel very good about. So my life began to turn around. Well, a very short version of the whole thing, but I left the Foreign Service then and began trying to figure out how to coach other people through some of these twists and turns, some of the reversals and comings around that typified my own life. And so I started doing that. Of course, I was really incompetent in the beginning of the 1980s. Didn't know what I was teaching or exactly what to say. But it gradually began to come together when I joined the Giraffe Heroes Project, which was started not by me, but by a remarkable woman named Dan Medlock in the early 1980s, and it was all about getting people to stick their necks out for the common good.
Right.
And I began to realize that was really the key, that there were plenty of people with good ideals that wanted to be good in the world, but getting them to combine that good spirit with actually doing something was really difficult. And Ann and I and the Giraffe Project have been about how to do that, how to connect the, if you will, the spiritual engine with the drivetrain, if you will, how to move ideals into action to help make things better in the world. So we've been teaching that for 20 years, and finally, like I said, at a point about 2 years ago, I said, darn, we know a lot. We've got a lot of experience. We've watched people doing this. Let's put it into a book. Let's put everything we know about creating positive change into a book. So that's the book. And the book is titled Stick Your Neck Out because that's the absolute key of the Giraffe Project. It's that good ideals aren't enough. Wanting to make a positive difference isn't enough. Just the wantingness isn't enough. You have to do something. And almost always that's scary. And all your listeners know that. Whenever you try to stand up in a city council meeting or something, or some disputed work or in a community, someone else says, shut up and sit down, or don't embarrass yourself. It's tough to keep going sometimes to do what you think is right. So this book is about both inspiring people to stick their necks out and giving them a whole lot of practical tools to do that without getting their heads chopped off.
Right. And one of the things that I like about the book, the almost second subtitle, is Service as a Path of a Meaningful Life. And that's, to me, in my journey, that's what I've discovered is the path to a meaningful life also, is sort of service and what you can do for others. Now, like I said, I used to be a community activist, and I still do some work like that before I did this. But what do you think is the number one problem or the number one difficulty doing sort of local and community activism that people have?
Well, there are a lot of difficulties that I'm sure most of your listeners are aware of, but they've never tried it. One of them, I think, is getting clear on what you want to do. And the answer to this is to get very clear about what you care about. What is it in your community you care about? What problem, what public problem is there that really bugs you? And no one else is fixing it, and it's staring you in the face. In my mind, that's like putting a sign on that problem saying, this is for you. No one else is doing it. So, you know, the first difficulty is just defining what you care about, what issues really concern you. This also ties into that whole question of meaning, which is a key part of this book. Because when you start working on something you care about, the work becomes meaningful. The work is meaningful. And one of the key points of the book is that when you do something that's really meaningful, when you do something that just speaks to you, when you do something that you know you're going to put there to do, there's a lot more passion, a lot more courage behind it. You're much more likely to make the right moves. You're much more likely to inspire other people to follow you or give you money to volunteer, whatever. But the first step is getting clear on what you care about. In my life, you know, for most of my young life, what I cared about was adventure. That's it. I climbed mountains. I dodged bullets. It was one adrenaline rush after the other, but that's what I cared about. And at a certain point, that was just too shallow. And what I discovered was what I really cared about, what really made my life come alive, what produced passion in my own life, was service. And that's where that secondary title of the book comes from, because I'm absolutely convinced. I mean, I watch people do it now, hundreds of people who lead meaningful lives, and in every case, it comes through some kind of service. And it doesn't mean Mother Teresa. I talked to a bunch of cadets at the Air Force Academy, for example, a couple of months ago, and I said, you know, service doesn't mean you have to join a non-profit or wear a sackcloth and ashes and, you know, whatever. You're in the armed services, and there's a reason why it's called a service or government service, whatever. You can be of service in a government agency. You can be of service as a business person. You can be of service as a medical or legal professional, or you can be of service flipping hamburgers. It doesn't make any difference. It's half the service all around us. You just have to find it for yourself.
Yeah. And I mean, then, you know, I'll add my own personal testimony to that, but I know that I never feel more fulfilled than that when I think that I'm in the middle of doing something that's causing good and helping others. And so again, that's, I originally scheduled you because the publisher of the book sent out an interesting email about you being on the no-fly list, and then they sent me they sent me the book, and then I just fell in love with the book. So again, thanks for writing that book. I want to encourage anybody out there who does any type of community activism. Like I said before, whether it is trying to make sure your trash gets picked up on the right day, or you know, going to the governor's office, making sure people have health care, you know, the health care coverage they deserve, this book can help you and will help you. And we should thank John for doing that. Well, let's move on to that whole no-fly issue. Why don't you give us some background on that and what exactly is going on?
Well, I'll give you as much background as I've got. Okay. A lot. I was flying down, or trying to fly down from Seattle to Oakland to see my grandkids. And I usually, you know, go to the automatic ticket thing at the airport where I don't have to stand in line. And the machine said I couldn't do that, and I had to go to the counter. Went to the counter. Alaska Airlines clerk there looked at me and looked at my driver's license, poked some things, some buttons on the computer, and looked across. And she asked for my driver's license again, and I disappeared for 10 or 15 minutes. And I'm waiting for a plane, so I'm sitting there wondering what's happening. She comes back and she says, it turns out that you're on this list, this no-fly list, but we've cleared you for this trip. You can go down and see your grandkids, but you have to get this settled with the transportation security organization, Transportation Security
Administration.
And she gave me a piece of paper. When I came back from that trip, I did what she suggested. I went on the website, the TSA website, and it said basically that I was on a list of people who, if I get the quotation right, posed or were suspected of posing a security risk to the United States or to transportation. I said, what? I said, what? In other words, I'm a suspected terrorist. A traitor to my country, if you will. I said, how can this be? I served my country. I was in Vietnam for a year and a half. I consider myself a patriot. I love my country, and now I'm on a list of my country's enemies. This is crazy.
I mean, and it's, you know, your name is John Graham. It's not, you know, it's not an Arabic name or some weird name that you normally associate with being on that list. Or
that's right. I mean, even if you were profiling, I'm a 63-year-old white male. You know, I hardly fit the prototype of a terrorist. So I tried calling the TSA Washington D.C. and I just got a complete runaround. And then I downloaded forms from the TSA website that said I had to do this to start clearing my name. And I sent them what they asked for, notarized copies of everything from my birth certificate to a passport, all kinds of stuff. And needless to say, I've heard absolutely nothing from them now. It's been 2 months. But the most chilling thing, Cole, the most chilling thing in all of this is that there was a little statement in a paper handed me at the airport that said, even if you manage to convince us to clear your name can never be taken off this what they call a watch list. The name can never be taken off. And I said, well, wait a minute. Here I'm being accused of being a traitor, a terrorist, a threat to my own country. You've given me no chance to explain or defend myself. And not only that, but I can never be taken off this list. So even if you let me fly one trip at a time, I have this like sword of Damocles hanging over my head. And I travel for a living. I give speeches and stuff all over the place. And so this is not only an assault on my civil liberties, it's an assault on my livelihood. And then I found out that I wasn't alone. There are thousands of people on this list. Some of your listeners may have read our story that made the headlines this last week about an 11-month-old baby that was put on the list.
That's crazy.
There's airline pilots on the list. There's Senator Ted Kennedy was put on the list. It's just nuts.
What was their rationale for putting you on the list?
That's the thing that I've been puzzling with, because in the case of the 11-month-old baby, clearly it was some kind of screw-up in the computer or mistaken identity or something. Now, that may very well be the case in my case as well. There could be, in fact, there is a wanted criminal named John Graham. It's a very common name. So maybe they're confusing me with this fellow, accused of murder in South Dakota or something.
That's something.
You know? What if it is a mistaken identity? Here I am. I'm president of an organization called the Giraffe Heroes Project. Our purpose is to move people to stick their necks out for the common good. We find people who are doing that, sticking their necks out, and we honor them and make them as famous as we can. And sometimes these people are, you know, making life uncomfortable for government. They're whistleblowers. They see a corruption in a company or in a government agency, for example. In fact, one of the last giraffes that we've honored was someone who blew the whistle on these defense contracts in Iraq that were grossly overpaying from a company. So maybe it's that. Then I thought, well, maybe, and I was on a local television show just a couple of weeks ago, and the interviewer held up a copy of my book and said, Graham, what are you talking about? You wrote a book called Stick Your Neck Out. It's all about getting other people to see a problem and try to fix it, and even if it means embarrassing public officials who are not doing their job. It's the book that got you on this list. I said, wait a minute. This book is not that kind of a book. It's a book about solving public problems. Well, what do you think? There's also the fact that part of my work is overseas. I've tried to use what I've learned in diplomacy as a foreign service officer and sort of turn it around. And for the last 10 years or so, I spent quite a bit of time as an international peace builder, peacemaker, working with Israelis and Palestinians and people in the Sudan and other war-torn places, trying to do what I can with my skills to help get these people to talk to each other, solve their conflict. Well, in the course of that, I go to places like refugee camps in South Beirut, and I talk to Palestinians. And you know, when you're active in making peace or trying to build peace, you have to talk to all sides, and that includes some pretty unsavory characters from time to time. So maybe it's my work as an international peacemaker that got me in trouble. So, you know, my head can spin, and I want to say very clearly that I am not a conspiracy theorist. I'm a very flat-footed guy. I get in arguments with my kids all the time about how all these stupid plots are just that. None of it is real. I don't believe that Rassi, Noel, Fury, JFK, all this stuff. I just sort of laugh at it. And now I'm looking at this thing. Wait a minute. The federal government has slowed me down a lot by putting me on this list. And maybe it's mistaken identity, but maybe not. So that's where my thinking is, Cole. I just don't know. And the fact that I don't know makes it even more an assault on my civil liberties.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the scary thing is, for us and people who listen to the show, this show is a show about progressive Christianity and trying to create some change in Christian politics. And that sort of means agitating the powers that be in the country currently. You know, and who knows if it's the same person, you know, whoever decides to put names on that list. I mean, is it, you know, do they have one guy who's the list guy and he picks names out, or can you nominate somebody for it, or, you know?
Well, they give you that. When you ask that answer, in fact, if any of your listeners can Google the Transportation Security Administration, and they'll get all this bureaucratic backtrack. And one of the things it says is that agencies put names on the list. That's all it says. Agents. Now, what does that mean? Somehow I don't think the Fish and Game agency
right.
is putting my name on this list. It's the FBI or some law enforcement agency. But they don't tell you, and there's absolutely no way to defend yourself. This is one interesting thing. I think is interesting is that my story has been out there now for about a month or so, and I've talked to lots of people, been on media programs, and I've gotten hundreds of letters and emails in response from people. I would say, I don't know, at least a third of the responses I'm getting are from people that probably don't vote the way I do. They're probably more a libertarian or even far right that are really concerned about this as a civil liberty issue.
Right.
In fact, I'm on a couple of real right-wing, you know, pro-gun lobby websites and stuff. My story's up there as an example of things they want to fight. So I'm getting allies in this from all over the political spectrum. There are a lot of people from the right to the left that see this as a civil liberties issue and think that the government has no business doing this. It's not America. It's not Chile and the Pinochet in the United States.
One thing I've been trying to get a hold on, my name's Josh, by the way, John.
Hi.
With that story about the 11-year-old infant, 11-year-old, the 11-month-old who was stopped in the airport and was on the no-fly list, and that article mentioned several other infants and toddlers who had been stopped and because they were on that list. And the question is raised about names and people having the same name and being that mixed up. How much detail, is there to identify people? Do they do this by social security number? Do they do address, description? I mean, because there are so many common names that can get mixed up pretty easily. So how do they distinguish?
Yeah, they won't tell you. It's
okay.
Part of what makes it so magic. There's absolutely zero information on how your name got on the list. I have no idea. Someone once told me that there were like 10,000 John Grahams if you canvass all the phone books in America. And they sounded like John Smith.
Right.
And so if one John Graham puts 10,000 people on the list, I mean, that's nuts.
Well, have you heard from any other John Grahams out there?
I've heard from one other John Graham whose name is on the list, but no more than that. And I've heard from other John Grahams who are not on the list, so I just don't know.
It's amazing. You know, it's funny and it's scary because it just seems there's no accountability and like I said, once your name's on there, you can never take it off. You're still on the watch list. To me, the funny thing would be if you find out that it's because of your activism work, your peace work, or your work with Draft Heroes and helping people stake their necks out. I mean, I think if the government finds anybody who agitates or creates change as a threat, I mean, that's really kind of a scary thought.
Well, it's a very scary thought. Like I said, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I just don't tend to think that way. But there's so many dangerous signs in it. It's scary, but I've taken it more on as a challenge. It's very clear now that I'm fighting not just for me. I'm fighting for, I don't know, tens of thousands of people on this list. And I've written, and that lines out now to 30 different congressmen and senators on the right committee. I've got two offers to deal with all my legal fees if I tend to file a civil suit, which I may. I'm eager to talk to more and more people and to bring this issue to the attention of more and more people. I mean, we've got to do something to say enough. I mean, I'm just so proud of that woman in Concord, Texas, who D.C., who was taken her beliefs and just stared at George Bush in the face to stop the war.
This is probably
the assault on civil liberties is also an important issue, and I'm not going to stop. I mean, they picked on the wrong guy. I know something. I mean, I worked on the Hill for a year. I'm an experienced negotiator. I'm head of the Giraffe Viewers Project. I have a lot of friends and contacts. They picked on the wrong guy, and I'm going to see this through.
Good. I have a question for you, John. This is probably a segue, a perfect question for this, but like, would you say that more people have been hindered in the current political climate? And also, how would you suggest that they come over that hindrance in the current political climate?
Is that for activism?
Yeah, for activism.
In some ways, it works both ways. In some areas, things have gotten so bad. I'm thinking mostly of environmental policy, education policy, some of the attempts to change social security, whatever, that it brings people out of the woodwork and makes it almost easier to protest because people that normally wouldn't do anything now see the problem as really extreme and are protesting or getting active or at least sending money to activist groups that wouldn't have done so otherwise. I don't know for sure, but I'd be willing to bet that the more, for example, the danger increases of drilling in the Arctic, the more contributions go to the Sierra Club. I mean, that's just the way it works. So, in some ways, it makes it easier because it draws the lines more graphically, and at a certain point, people just say, damn it, that's enough, and like Mr. Shea, they decide to do something about it. The other side of it is that it is kind of scary for a lot of people because the government does have a lot of power, and they can keep you from taking an airplane flight, or they can do all kinds of things. I mean, we have some of the abuses at Guantanamo Bay, for example. This is a government that, I don't know what the right word is, if I do my words carefully, but at least seems rather arrogant when it comes to the rights of other people, especially other non-Americans. They're not fooling around.
Yeah, I think arrogant is an appropriate term there, and I gotta do this real quick. You're listening to Christian Dissent on WRFM, Radio Free Nashville, Pasco, Tennessee. I'm your host, Cole Wakefield, sitting in it here with Joey Hood and Josh Tinley. And speaking with us is John Graham, the president of the Giraffe Heroes Project.
Mentioned the fear aspect of this, that because of these measures that have been taken, some people will be afraid to stick their neck out. What do you say to somebody who has strong feelings but then sees how Cindy Sheehan has been treated by some people in some circles and sees how certain people have had their civil liberties restricted? And
you can even apply this to the Joe Wilson, Valerie Plume,
somebody
who was, you know, somebody who just publicly disagreed with the government, and his wife was, you know, outed as a CIA agent. You know.
Right. Well, you know, I deal with it a lot because my organization finds and honors people who have stuck their necks out. We always talk to them about, why did you do it? How did you overcome the obstacle? In other words, you ask the same questions you're asking. And right off, a lot of the time, the first impulse is just anger, frustration. Doggone it, this is wrong. I have to do something about it. But as you can learn from my book, I feel that anger and frustration are, while they're often the catalyst for positive civic action, problem solving, they're not very good as a long-term support. At a certain point, you need to move toward a more solid footing for your activism. And here we circle around to something we were talking about 20 minutes ago, and that's meaning. I found in talking to giraffes, and you say, why did you do this? Why did you take this risk? The first thing most of them say was, well, that's a dumb question, John. I mean, what do you expect me to do? This thing was going on in my backyard. No one else was doing anything, so I had to do something. And they talk about being pulled or pushed to become active. Some of them use religious or spiritual terms, you know, God guided me with that. But many of them, most of them, don't. Most of them speak in quite secular language about, well, what else was I supposed to do? And you get the impression that they really were being pushed, guided, led, if you will, even if they don't use spiritual terms. And the more you talk to them, the more you begin to understand that what they're doing is doing something that draws them into an increased meaning in their own lives. They get active in the problem, whether it's living in the Arctic, or protesting the war, or maybe it's a local issue that the schools in their district are no damn good, and lots of things need to improve. Or maybe it's just pothole in the road, but something grabs them, and they see a meaningful role to play. By what do I mean? I mean something that when you're doing it, you know you're on the right path. There's a sense of excitement about it, a sense of being in the right place at the right time. I'm willing to bet every single listener has done something meaningful at some point, a meaningful relationship, a meaningful action, a meaningful job, something at some point. You know what I'm talking about. Well, when you approach things with that level of meaning, it's amazing how sometimes the obstacles become smaller. Well, they don't become smaller, but they seem smaller, and you gain more courage to confront them. And I thought about how that works. And I think what happens is that when you're doing something with meaning, let's say, for example, that you're determined to make Medicare work. This is an example. And so you're a doctor, or you have some medical background, you have some skills, and so you start writing congressmen and joining organizations that on healthcare issues, and you get more and more involved in it, and you see yourself making a difference, the issue becomes really meaningful because you begin to realize that you've been prepared and are preparing your whole life for this issue. Your skills, everything is pointing you toward making a difference on this issue. This issue, in this case, Medicare reform, has your name all over it. And so, if an obstacle appears, for example, you run out of money in your cause, or someone thumps you with a dirty editorial in the local paper or something, or some other reversal, then these obstacles, these scary things, become less obstacles and more like speed bumps on a path that you're already committed to take. It's kind of a difficult concept. Maybe it doesn't come across very well over the radio, but but I'm convinced that that's what gives activists courage to keep going and makes them as effective as they are. When you realize something's meaningful in your life, you're just a whole lot more effective in pursuing it, and the obstacles and speed bumps, the obstacles become less scary and more like speed bumps on this path that you're already committed to taking. I'm getting on a soapbox here, but this is a key point, and it's a key point in my book, how to get to that level of meaning and then how to harness it to solve problems.
Okay. Well, let me pose to you a scenario, something that actually happened here in Tennessee recently. There was a young man by the name of Zach who was forced into an ex-gay camp, so a religious ex-gay camp, against his will, didn't want to go, and he, right before he left, he wrote on his blog that, you know, his parents were sending him here, he didn't want to go, and boy, he wishes there was something that somebody could do. Well, this sort of energized a lot of people, a lot of youth around the world, and there was a group of people in Memphis who started doing organizing, and they put together, a protest outside the place that it was going on, and they sort of figured out early on that they needed to, you know, why they were using this kid as inspiration, they needed to also make it a much broader issue than one a kid, but. You know, what has happened since then is this name, you know, came the Free Zach movement. And, you know, so this kid's name was sort of the inspiration, and his image was sort of the inspiration behind battling these ex-gay camps and this ex-gay movement. And then he came out and sort of said, you know, hey, I'm done with this, but I'm 16 and I want to live my life and I don't want to be the poster boy for this movement. So how does an important movement, which would be sort of educating people on ex-gay camps and trying to fight against that, but they just lost their, you know, sort of, you know, galvanizing image. How do they recover from that?
Well, I happened to see CNN, I remember it was Larry King Live, a whole hour on this issue. Mm-hmm. And it's a major issue. Zach is not the only kid caught in these kind of re-indoctrination camps or whatever they are.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an enormous amount of background from psychology, from studies and psychologists that it doesn't work. Whatever. And discuss the issue itself if you want. But there's two things here. First of all, the group in Memphis was absolutely right to broaden the issue beyond that. This is not just one kid. I understand there are a lot of these camps. And then beyond that, there's a larger issue of gayness and discrimination against gays. This is a large national issue that is simply playing out in one form here in this camp in Tennessee. So the one thing that the group is really smart in doing, in my view, was to get beyond Zach's problem to the problem, and identify that problem. That does a couple things. First of all, it focuses on what the issue really is, and second of all, it should allow them to keep going even if Zach doesn't keep going. The second thing that interests me about the example is that in bringing attention to the camp in a way they have, the group seems to demonstrate that they're media savvy, and you have to be media savvy day, and there's a couple chapters in my book that deal with that. So the Free Zach movement or whatever, or Mrs. Sheehan, for example, in Crocker, either she's a media, she was born as a media genius, or she has people around her who know what they're doing. But you have to know how to use the media these days to get the point across. So there's two things in that example that are interesting. One is the recognition that the issue must be broad. The Giraffe Project, for example, is about moving people to stick their necks out for the common good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm fighting the civil liberties thing, not for John Graham, but for the whole principle of civil liberties. The second point is that whatever you do, you have to teach yourself to be, or get people around you who are, media savvy.
Right. It's a tough game with the media nowadays. Another question I have, just sort of from a former arts, I'm not as much of an actress as I used to be, but I used to do a lot of, I'm from Arkansas, and I live in Tennessee, but did a lot, and tried to do a lot of organizing in Arkansas. And, you know, working with national organizations, and we'd always have people come down from, you know, D.C. or wherever and try to organize, and those are usually the greatest failures. Because, it seems to me that organizing in the South just seems to be a tough thing to do. And at least for people who've done it both places, I've never, tried to do it anywhere but the South. I mean, do you find a difference in trying to do activism in the South part of the country versus the rest of the country, or is it, is it the same problems everywhere?
Well, first of all, your voice is sort of fading. Is it my phone or is it your...
Can I
hear you.
Okay,
am I coming across okay?
Yeah, you're coming across fine. It must be here.
Okay. I never thought about that. I'm dealing with a direct project that's now international, and certainly it's national. We have a program, tools programs, for example, all over the country, and we've honored giraffes from every state in the Union, including Tennessee, Arkansas, the South. And it's interesting, there are a lot of people, we've honored quite a few people from Texas, Florida. So, I don't think there's anything particular about the South. I mean, I'm trying to find with my life and my books and my writings and my speeches common ground, the kind of messages that resonate with everybody, and I think to some extent I've succeeded. And when you talk about, for example, meaning, and the need for the relationship between meaning and courage, or the necessity to tackle public problems, I don't think it makes any difference whether you're in Arkansas or Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, some segments of the population in certain areas tend to vote a certain way, but then again, look at some of the issues. For example, like the civil liberties. And my experience that right wing and left wing sort of come together on this. I think one of the things that Democrats and progressives need to do is to find better ways to language some of these issues so as to explore that common ground. There are, for example, a lot of Republicans that are environmentalists. That are pretty green, and they view the concept of stewardship as a good, solid conservative value. Well, why can't they work with the progressives and the Sierra Club left? I mean, why not? The work that Jim Wallis is doing with Sojourners and some other progressive religious people, I think, is really important, trying to define values and not to walk away and let the Bush White House and their political offices define values for America.
Right. That's definitely what we're about here. Well, do you guys have anything? Any other questions or comments?
I just want to say that I think your work is really inspiring. I haven't read the book yet, but I'm very inclined to read it. I hope Cole lends it to me.
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
Thank you. Hey, by the way, there's a website. Can I get the
Go right in.
Yeah, it's www.giraffe.org. And on it, you'll find all kinds of links to our work with giraffes, our work with schools, my books and speeches. And it's worth exploring because we're doing our bit. We're trying to make a difference the way we do it. And we urge everyone else to do the same in whatever way makes sense for them.
But I'm with Joey and thanking you for the work you do and the work that Giraffe's doing. I'm certainly glad that I got the email from your publisher because it introduced me to the Giraffe Project. I hadn't heard about it before, and it is a very exciting, very, I think, doing important work. So thank you, John, and all your people who work on that project with you. And thank you for writing that book, Stick Your Neck Out, which I think you can get it from the giraffe.org website, correct?
Yeah, you can get it from the website, you can get it from Amazon.com, you can go down to your local bookstore, you can get it in all the normal ways, one buys books.
So pick it up if you're interested in any sort of community activism or creating change, pick up Stick Your Neck Out. Thanks a lot for getting up early and talking to us, John.
It's my pleasure, thank you. Cole.
And keep us updated on your no-fly list.
I will.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was John Graham, the president of the Giraffe Heroes Project and author of Stick Your Neck Out. And it's a great book. Like I just said, pick it up. And we're going to take a quick breather here to decide what we're going to talk about for the last part of the show. Until then, listen to a quick little song from the DC Talk solo album.
Church Day there,
and they admitted for free entire Christian families who brought church bulletins to prove their church attendance, and those without church bulletins were charged regular admission price. So this guy called the county office or whatever, the mayor's office, and said, okay, I'm not a churchgoer, you know, whether or not to go to church, or an atheist or whatever, or I'm not a churchgoer, but, you know, how do I take part in this deal? You know, there should be some way for me to get this perk. And they said that the chief executive from the Williamson County Mayor's Rogers Anderson's office said, indicated that an alternative for non-churchgoers was to print a fake program to gain free admission to the fair. Because, you know, if you're not a churchgoer, you obviously don't have any morality to begin with. So it's not...
Or just go into the church, stay for 5 minutes.
Yeah, really, you know. Or check out the church dumpster on Monday.
Yeah, or your local recycling bin.
But, I couldn't believe that, you know. Well, we want to honor Christian families, and we want to honor people for going to church and bring a program. But if you don't go to church, just go ahead and print you out, make you up a false program, and turn it in. And that's public officials here in Central Tennessee. Wow.
It does say that synagogue, mosque, and temple goers do not enjoy special promotions.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it was
it seemed a little absurd.
Don't bring me.
So if a Muslim, if they had a leaflet, they could be like, it has to be Christian.
Well, I don't know if any Muslims would actually go to the
Muslims live in Williamson County.
Yeah, but that's a good question. If you are a brave and Muslim, I don't go to Williamson County, and I'm a white Christian, so...
I'm from Williamson County. I'm afraid of living there.
Well, actually, I do shop there occasionally.
Probably shouldn't say too much because I think it's only about a mile.
Sure. That might be most of our.
Starts. It might be.
I watch our listener numbers. It's like, talking about Williamson County. I was just trying to get some perspective for. I don't think it's wrong to say that Williamson County is sort of like a Nashville white flight.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it is.
And we had those in Arkansas, Little Rock, there's Cabot, and the surrounding areas. So that's just to give people a perspective of Williamson County.
There are good people.
There are good people there, yes.
Yeah, as a county, I can see that.
Yeah. And that, by far, I do not mean to judge or label everybody in Williamson County, but that's just the type of place it is. And there's a huge mall. And
Cool Springs is a nice place to go for your shopping.
But you don't find many Muslims.
Right.
Or black people. Or Jewish people. There's probably a lot of Jewish people, but they just don't make themselves known. That's just how it was in Cabot. So, anyway, we have lost all listenership and sponsorship possibilities from Williamson County. But that's okay, because we are a nationwide show online, and we can give up Williamson.
International.
Yeah, worldwide. So we can give up Williamson County, and we'll just pick up all the other ones around it.
Yeah, another thing I heard about the Williamson County Fair, I got a press release about the two main Democrats who are in this race for first seat next year,
right.
Carol Ford Jr. and Rosalyn Perita. They were putting together in kind of an unofficial event at the Williamson County Fair because they had not been asked to speak or hold a forum there as the Republican candidates. I guess the Williamson County Republicans were able to hold an event hosting the Republican senatorial candidate.
Well,
the Democrats were not doing the same. That's my understanding. I could be totally wrong.
Well, I mean, and that's not a surprise. It's probably the people who are on the board of the Williamson County.
They're pretty much the only Democrat in Williamson County.
Now, there is a Williamson County Democrat Association. They did do the, or at least one person that can email a press release.
They meet at the Waffle House. Williamson County Democrats. Waffle House is good. I like Waffle House. But their Waffle Houses are small, so I guess probably put everybody in there. You know, which is amazing, for people who've never been to Central Tennessee, Middle Tennessee is how we have people label it. is really an interesting place, because Nashville is an incredibly progressive town in some respects, but it's also an incredibly conservative town in other respects. I mean, it has Vanderbilt and it has Belmont, you know, Nashville is a good school, but
it even has, like, you know, Vanderbilt Divinity School and then the Vanderbilt Owen School of Management. So right. You have right there some totally different perspectives.
So it's sort of like wherever there's, you know, it's wherever there's this, like, massive right-wing influence on Nashville, there's also somewhere there's another institution that's just as heavy on the progressive side, and it really makes for an interesting melding of cultures, and which I like. I mean, I think it makes Nashville interesting.
Yeah.
And it sort of actually creates an atmosphere of sort of intellectual respect that people have for one another, whether they're conservative or liberal, that you don't get in places like Williamson County.
Which we love still, by the way.
We love Williamson County. I haven't been
around. We kid because we love.
Yes, because I haven't been around much. I've been to Nashville and Franklin. That's the only places I've been since I've lived here. So those are the only two places I talk about. So
Murfreesboro is a nice place. Good city.
Listeners, come on down to Middle Tennessee. But anyway, yeah, Nashville is not what you think. I guarantee you, all these people who are listening from other places, and you think Nashville is Hickville or country music city, USA, they're wrong. I thought it was that, but you don't wear cowboy hats. Matter of fact, we know who you are when you come to town because you guys wear the cowboy hats and the get-ups. So, anyway, was there anything? Let's see, what else has gone on this week?
Well, I was going to mention the official pullout of Israeli settlements in Gaza.
Oh, that's right. A literal pullout, because they are being
pulled out, dragged by their arms. And it's tough, because I'm of the persuasion, I think that this is going to be good in the long run.
Right.
I mean, I would like to see a two-state solution, and I think there are good and bad people on both sides, and people that are helping, people that are hurting on both sides. But it's sad to see some of these families just dragged out, especially the ones with children. On the other hand, I think a lot of these families have been kind of subversive through what they've tried to do. So it's tough.
There's
no getting
it. It definitely speaks to the sort of how complicated things are in that entire situation, because, you know, people want to go, well, either you're pro-Israel or you're anti-Semitic, or either you're
pro-Palestine or you're anti-human rights,
right?
Or something. And it's really it's so difficult.
Yeah, because there have been abuses on both sides, and there have been unreasonable people on both sides.
And I mean, the whole Jewish migration to Israel is a result of just rampant anti-Semitism in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't blame them for returning to Israel. It's difficult.
And that could be another. I mean,
it's so complicated.
Another show. And you know what? There's a whole other group of people there. You're in the middle. There are Christians.
There's a lot of Palestinian Christians. And there's a lot of American Christians who think that if the Palestinians can be eradicated at the end of the world.
Yeah.
That's
totally
another.
I was going to bring that up. Well, it's because, like, no, we like Jewish people. We want to help them. We want to help them establish, you know, rebuild the temple, so we can be raptured.
Which I think it's so anti-biblical. I don't think it's even worth
discussing. Well, anti-biblical has never stopped anybody from proclaiming a biblical prophecy. Well. That was a great segue for what we have. We have now a song written by somebody in this room.
I used to be in a band.
Oh, wow.
For many years. This isn't from my band. I was in a band for 6.5 years, and then I tried to go solo without much luck, because it was all, I don't play guitar or drums.
Mm-hmm.
I play piano and bass. And I kind of sing.
So at the same time, piano and bass?
No. So my solo stuff is all piano, keyboards, and vocals, and This is one song I wrote about the Arab-Israeli situation. It's called Palestinian Girl, and it's kind of a Romeo and Juliet type thing about some people in the West Bank.
Great, and that's what we will send us out on that song. This has been Christian Descent Live with Cole, Joey, and Josh. And on 98.9 WRFM, Pasco, Tennessee, Radio Free Nashville, Low Power to the People, www.radiofreenashville.org, Christian Descent at radiofreenashville.org, or christiandescent.blogspot.com. And here we are with Palestinian Girl, with Josh Timmy.
Yeah, it looks like it did.
Pacifica was made possible by Butler Communications, providing internet streaming services for WRFN in Nashville and throughout the world. The Cumberland Greens, Eric Lewis, Sandy Heffler, Al Levinson, Glenn Christman, Carl Evertson, Bill Harkey, Stephen Mallett, Jim Seelan, and Dick Houghton, and James Savage. ¶¶